Have you ever noticed on our episodes that we tend to say things like, found everywhere but the Florida Keys? Well, on today's episode, we are doing a special topic just for the Florida Keys and talking about the Lower Keys marsh rabbit.
Welcome to Naturally Florida, a podcast about Florida's natural areas and the wild things that live here. I'm Lara Milligan.
And I'm Shannon Carnevale.
This podcast is brought to you by UF IFAS Extension in Polk and Pinellas counties.
Real quick, I just wanted to give you a heads up that my audio quality for today's episode is subpar. I made a little mistake in recording on the last episode. Shannon did her absolute best to make it sound okay for you, so apologies in advance, and I promise I will do better next time.
I am so excited for today's topic, Lara. I have seen our subject species all over Winter Haven, Lakeland, and unincorporated Polk County this week, really all month, and it is the adorable marsh rabbit.
That's awesome. I have been seeing another species that we're briefly going to talk about today, which is the cottontail rabbit. But yes, the bunnies or rabbits or however you want to talk about them are definitely out and about right now.
So many. I mean, just driving around town the other day, picking up my dog, I saw, I'm not even exaggerating, probably 40 of them in like a 10 block radius.
That's insane.
they like being near the water. I guess it goes in their name.
You have the habitat for sure.
Exactly. Exactly. So whenever we get a bunch of rabbits, you know, this time of year, I feel like I get a lot more questions about them in the office and actually just from friends and neighbors as well. You know, why rabbits? Why are there so many? Why are there so many right now? Do they hibernate? Why do they disappear? Well, one of the reasons we think they disappear is because in the ecosystem, they are primarily a prey source. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I hesitate to say this, but my colleague, who I'll keep unnamed just for purposes of this, but he calls them nature's popcorn. So yes, they are cute to us, but they are a great food source for many others.
Yes, lots of things eat our little marsh rabbits, but it's because they really are. They're a great source of protein in the ecosystem, and they do a wonderful job of converting that lakefront vegetation and marshy vegetation into a protein source if we get right down to it. So all sorts of things that hunt near water will eat these rabbits, things like large owls, bobcats, alligators, foxes, any of your predators around water will also go after the marsh rabbit. And I would say that's probably true of cottontails as well, yeah?
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah. So another good thing about rabbits, though, is because they're so good at grazing those lakefront vegetations, they do a wonderful job of dispersing different seed sources. Hopefully, on your lakefront, you have a lot of native vegetation that they're dispersing the seeds of. But that's another wonderful ecological role that these rabbits play.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me. I surprisingly get a lot of emails for scat ID. And believe it or not, rabbit scat is probably up there with the number one
really
picture I get sent. Yeah.
Oh, well, at least it's not like a gross one to get.
I know. It's easy. It's pretty easy.
It's very easy. They're kind of cute. I know my dog likes looking for them.
Did you just call poop cute?
I did. It is cute. They're like little tiny like marbles. They're really cute. Anyway, they're perfectly round. Anyway, a little pile of rabbit poop makes me so happy in the yard. I have a bunch of rabbits in my yard. So I go outside, I'm like, oh, the rabbits were here.
Oh my gosh, that's so good. Okay, so on a more serious note, I mean, that is serious. We have two species of rabbits in Florida. We have the eastern cottontail, which is probably the more, I don't know, I want to say more common, but maybe not. Maybe it depends on where you are in the state after what Shannon just said. But we have the eastern cottontail and then the marsh rabbit. So before we dive into a particular subspecies of marsh rabbit that we're going to talk about today, we just wanted to briefly help you know, like, if you're like, how do I know which one I'm seeing? Tell apart a cottontail from a marsh rabbit.
Yes, I think this is important because I, for the longest time, did not realize we had two species because I only ever see one of them. And when I heard about the cottontail, I was like, oh, have I been seeing that one all along? And I looked it up and no, I think I'm only seeing the marsh rabbit where I am.
Yeah. I mean, that would definitely make sense for where you're located. But Yeah, I think mine would probably be like the opposite. It's like I would see a marsh rabbit and be like, that is a strange looking cottontail. You know?
Right.
Until you learn. So here's how you know. Cottontail gets a really good common name. So another key characteristic of the cottontail rabbit is their tail is large. Well, for a rabbit, larger. And the underside of it is white, which is pretty evident even when they're sitting, but especially when they are running away. And so definitely look for their tail. In terms of like otherwise their overall appearance, they're a lighter colored rabbit compared to the marsh rabbit. So they both have peppered coats, but it's going to be more of a lighter, like a grayish color on the cottontail. And then if you ever get a chance to look like at the nape of their neck, and I'm like pointing to it like y'all can see me, it's more of like a rust color, which is a pretty cool characteristic that I didn't really learn about till later on, but it's definitely evident. In terms of habitat, and we've already alluded to this, but you're typically going to find cottontail rabbits more in higher, drier upland habitats compared to the marsh rabbit. And we'll talk more about a lot more about them in a minute. And then just in terms of like their kind of their head region, they have longer ears. And I always say like bulging eyes. Like to me, they always look like horrified.
Yes, they look scared all the time.
Yeah. So those couple things, white tail, scared looking eyes, big bulgy eyes, lighter colored coat, and higher and drier habitat for the cottontail. Now for the marsh rabbit, their tail is not really obvious and it lacks the white. So it's kind of the same color as their body. Their body does have that peppered appearance, but it's a much darker color. It's more of like a reddish brown. And in terms of their ears and eyes, they're smaller. People often say they have like smaller beady eyes. And then in terms of where they're found, they require fresh water, like a permanent source of fresh water. And so they will tend to be found in winter habitat.
Yeah. And whenever we're talking about differentiating two species and we're like, well, this one has longer ears and this one has shorter ears, like you normally need to see them right next to each other to really understand that. I don't think that's the case with the cottontail and the marsh rabbit. The marsh rabbit's ears are small enough that they always look like they have little baby bunny ears. So if you've seen the animated Robin Hood, really, it's a throwback. Okay. But the little bunny character who's got his cute little floppy baby ears, that is what a marsh rabbit's ears look like to me.
Yeah. And they're a little bit like more rounded too, I feel like. Than the cottontail. But yeah, so, and definitely if you look at a picture of them side by side too, it is helpful just for all the characteristics that we mentioned. It will really stand out when you compare them side by side. And I will link, I have a short video that compares and contrasts the two that we will link in the show notes.
Very helpful. Video evidence is always useful. So before we move on to the focus species today, the Lower Keys marsh rabbit, we wanted to talk a little bit about the scientific name of the marsh rabbits because we just think it's so interesting. The genus for both the cottontail and the marsh rabbit is Sylvilagus, and the species for the marsh rabbit is Palestris. And what's fun with scientific names is they tend to give you a little bit of a hint about what species you're looking at. So the Sylvilagus, the first part of that word is silva from Latin. And what does that mean, Lara?
It means forest. And yeah, it reminds me when we both took silviculture, which is very much related to the forest and managing and caring for our trees.
Yeah. And so you're going to see both of these species around forested areas. Then we also have the second half of the word, lagos, which could come from lagos, which means hare, or in this case, rabbit. And then the species name for the marsh rabbit is Palestris, which means of the marsh or a swampy species. We have a lot of species in Florida that have the specific epithet palustris. And so this is a word that you should be very familiar with if you've been listening to our podcast or if you've been trying to learn more about the species that are found in Florida ecosystems. But today we're going to be talking about one of the three subspecies of the marsh rabbit, and that is the Lower Keys marsh rabbit.
Yes, and this particular subspecies is the smallest of the three, and it only reaches a length of 14 to 16 inches.
So tiny. Cute.
And I don't know, I just feel like in so many of our species episodes, we say, oh, this particular species is found everywhere except the Keys.
Yeah.
You know, it was like every species, every snake, every whatever. Mm-hmm. So today, if you live in the Keys, this is a dedicated episode to you.
This is all for you guys or for the people visiting you.
Yes. Yes. Which is probably many of our listeners, or I hope so. So this particular subspecies is only found in the Keys. And you've probably heard us say the term endemic. So it is endemic to not only the Keys, but the lower Florida Keys. And adding to that, it is an endangered species at the federal level. So, and we're going to dive more into reasons why that is in a minute.
And just a reminder for all of our listeners, endemic, as Lara mentioned, it's something that we've said before on the podcast, but this means that it is only found in that area. It is native to that area and it has a small range. So the Lower Keys marsh rabbit, like Lara said, is endemic to the Lower Keys.
Yeah. And we talked about how many Shannon saw before. And if you learn anything about rabbits, I think they teach this in biology class about the different species and how much they reproduce and all that. So in terms of their breeding, the Lower Keys marsh rabbit breeds year round, but there's kind of peak breeding season, if you will, December through June. So We're in it. Yeah. They can produce, this is like, I don't even understand, 6 or 7 litters of 2 or 4 young per litter. So they're just
so 6 or 7 litters per year.
Yes.
Wow.
It's like you're just always giving birth. Like, I don't understand.
Well, I mean, they do say breeding like rabbits. So I guess there's a reason for it.
Yes. And as Shannon alluded to before, in terms of kind of the role that they play in eating vegetation, they are herbivores. And as would be, I guess, expected of an herbivore, their diet is going to vary based on the plants that are available throughout the year, but they'll eat a variety of vegetation everywhere from kind of our berry species, our blackberries, down getting into the roots, the rhizomes, the bulbs. They'll eat marsh grasses all the way up to duck potato and cattail. So wide variety of plants that they will eat. In terms of their lifespan, I mean, I feel like it's pretty good considering their size, but they could live up to 4 years in the wild.
Up to. Remember their role in the ecosystem when Lara tells you this next part.
But most do not live past 1 year of age, which I guess, so yeah, you got to crank out babies if you're only going to live that long for sustainability. So I think there's just some really cool fun facts about them because they are marsh rabbits. And I mentioned before, they actually need a permanent source of water. That's like a requirement for their habitat. And because of that, they are considered semi-aquatic and it's kind of bizarre to think about, but they are considered really good swimmers, which I have never witnessed, but like.
I have seen it, and I'm going to be honest, I thought it was a rat, and I was really not happy about it. But then I saw the ears, and I was like, oh, that poor rabbit. And then I remembered how much they like it.
So crazy. Yeah, and so they're known for like diving into the water to escape predators, and will actually spend a lot of time in the water. And actually, their hind legs have less fur and longer nails than like their cottontail relative to help them in the swimming process. So pretty cool.
Yeah, our backyard has a seawall because we're so close to a canal. But they hang out right on the seawall and they eat the aquatic plants while they sit on the seawall, which is why I get those tiny little piles of rabbit poop and I think they're cute. But anyway, they love eating the cattails, just like you said earlier.
And kind of fun fact about them is that I think when we typically think of rabbits, at least for me, who sees more cottontails than marsh rabbits, is the marsh rabbits can walk on all fours. Like typically you think of a rabbit and they're just always hopping like 2, 2, 2. But they have the ability to walk on all fours, which kind of helps them navigate through their habitat, which tends to be, you know, there's kind of like a lot of ground cover and things for them to navigate around. So it just makes them more agile in their dense vegetated areas.
It can be disconcerting to watch. At times, I watch them tiptoeing around my garden, and it really does truly look like they are tiptoeing because they will, their little back legs, they will stand up. Like Lara said, you expect them to hop. So it's a little odd when you see them kind of stand up a little bit and tiptoe on all 4 feet around things. It's odd, but it's a definite difference of behavior from other rabbits. So if you see a small brown red rabbit doing this, I think there's a really good chance you're looking at a marsh rabbit.
Yeah. And depending, I'd be curious what time of day you typically see. They are considered to be more nocturnal and I would even say crepuscular, more active at dawn and dusk.
Yeah, that's what I would say, based on the ones I see in my yard.
Right. Which also happens to be when their predators are most active, but you know, it is what it is. And that's why they tend to be found in areas where there are dense clusters of vegetation so that they can hide from those predators. So, and they're nimble that we talked about before with how they can move.
Mm-hmm. Now that we know a little bit more about what marsh rabbits eat and how their reproductive strategy works and where they're found, and things like that. Let's talk a little bit more specifically about the Lower Keys marsh rabbit and where you'll find them in the Lower Keys. The Lower Keys marsh rabbit primarily lives in vegetated communities around the freshwater and saltwater marshes in the Lower Keys from Big Pine Key to Boca Chica Key. And the types of marshes that you'll find them around include things like brackish water marshes, salt marsh, buttonwood marshes, transitional zones between mangroves at the lower elevations, and forested habitats like hammocks and pines in the higher elevations.
Yeah, they really like those transitional areas. That's key, really, to their habitat.
Right. And as a reminder, because this is an endangered species with such small populations, they've actually wound up having two unique genetic lineages within the population. One of those lineages is found primarily in the Big Pine Key area, and the other is primarily found in the Boca Chica Key area. They are separated and isolated, and so they don't mix genetically. This is mainly because of habitat fragmentation, which, in case we haven't defined that yet, habitat fragmentation happens when a large chunk of habitat is broken into smaller pieces that are cut through with something that prevents species from migrating between them. So it could be a road, it could be buildings, it could be an entire neighborhood. But habitat fragmentation is especially problematic in these smaller habitat areas.
Yeah, and in this particular case, the kind of two genetic lineages that Shannon talked about, one of them, the eastern population, is significantly larger than the western population. And that's really important to consider because when we have impacts, which the Keys, I feel like, tend to get lots of storms and things like that, which we're going to talk about in a minute, but that has really big potential to harm these populations. If, right, either of those get impacted, they don't have the ability to breed with one another to kind of rebound their population. So also factoring into one of the reasons that they are listed as endangered.
Right. And when Lara says one population has significantly more, I think it's important to point out we're talking 10 times more. So there's thought to only be 25 individuals in one of those lineages. So very, very, very small population numbers.
Yeah. And as Shannon mentioned with the habitat fragmentation, and really habitat destruction, this could really go for, you know, like pretty much all wildlife species, but that is a critical main threat for this particular species because of where they are located down in the Keys. And there's been lots of studies and research on this particular species, and they've documented over 50% of their habitat has been lost over the past several decades, mostly due to habitat destruction through development.
Yeah, this definitely feels like a common thread through a lot of our episodes that have to do with one particular species or another. So unfortunately, we are a big part of the problem.
Yeah. And for this particular species, again, because they are located in the Keys and with development and another factor that's happening all throughout the state, but also especially in the Keys, because they are basically little islands, there's sea level rise to factor in. And when you're an island and you have the sea level rising, it just really compounds what we call, it's called coastal squeeze, but basically, right, the ocean's rising, we've developed out to the coast. And so it's kind of like literally squeezing these species to, they have really nowhere to live and nowhere to go. And there was some staggering statistics looking at the impact of sea level rise and the associated habitat loss with this particular species, the Lower Keys marsh rabbit. And there was a study looking, they used aerial photography from 1959 to 2006, and they determined that there was a 64% net loss of their habitat, and the majority of that, estimated around 48%, was specifically due to sea level rise.
Yeah, especially considering all the development that happened between the 50s and the 2000s.
Yeah, and so just to put it into perspective, because I know there's differing thoughts. Like, I'm just right on sea level rise, climate change. We're not trying to get into that. I'm just sharing the statistics on sea level rise from NOAA sea gauge data. And for the gauge that's in the Keys where this species is located, there from 1971 to 2023, there was an average of 4.21 millimeters per year. But to put that into perspective, averaged out, there's 1.3 feet of sea level rise in a 100-year time frame based on that gauge data. So it's real, it's happening, and there's significant impacts, especially to some species more than others.
Right. And in case you didn't pick up on the writing between the lines, 1971 to 2023 is about 50 years. So we're talking about half of that has already occurred, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. These are islands that don't have a lot of elevation to begin with. So taking away 3/4 foot, what is that? I can't do math. Is that 8 inches of elevation? That can be significant.
Yeah. No, I remember, I mean, it's not in the Keys, but I was in the Everglades and they had one of those national park signs that had elevation, you know, when you go to other places and it was like elevation 3 feet. I'm like, this is hilarious and epic, but it's like,
yeah,
that's very important to factor in when we're talking, you know, 1.38 feet of sea level rise. So.
Yeah. And sea level rise in such a low elevation area has effects that are more diverse than flooding, right? So when we're talking about sea level rise, we're also talking about salinity changes in the ecosystem. This can affect whatever fresh water the rabbits are depending on because they do need both. Lower Keys marsh rabbits are often found in saltwater marshes, but they do need access to fresh water as well. And the change in salinity in the ecosystem can also change the habitat type and the vegetation type. So when you have species that are used to a certain level of salinity and that salinity changes, that species will die and another species will move in. The question is, does the new species that moves into this area that has an unusually high salinity compared to the past, is it the same structure that the rabbits need? Does it provide the same forage that the rabbits need? Does it change the predator-prey relationship by making them easier or harder to see? There's a lot of change that goes on when salinity changes in any ecosystem. And because these ecosystems and these populations are so extremely small, any change is going to amplify the impact on the Lower Keys marsh rabbit, which is a cute little guy we don't want to see go.
Yeah. And not to make it any more depressing, but there are a couple other significant threats that the Lower Keys marsh rabbit are facing. And one of those is domesticated and feral cats, which I feel like we had to have brought this up in one of our episodes when we talked about birds. But so domesticated and feral cats are definitely detrimental to their populations where they exist. That goes for the Lower Keys marsh rabbit as well as a variety of other species. Getting struck by vehicles is also a threat to them. And then there's some other kind of smaller, just different contaminants, fire ants, believe it or not, can factor in. Exotic vegetation can kind of basically take over their habitat and make it uninhabitable. And then there's also illegal poaching that to factor in. So,
yeah, poaching. Okay. Well, that seems like a good reason to move on to our call to action to help save the Lower Keys marsh rabbit, don't you think?
I think that's a great idea.
Okay. So we have, like Lara said, we have already mentioned this in other episodes, particularly the backyard bird habitat episode. But one of the best calls to action you can do if you actually live in the Keys is to keep your domesticated cats inside. This is important for a variety of threatened and rare species in the Keys. And this call to action, honestly, it goes for cats statewide. If you have a domestic cat that is a pet, protect your pet and the local wildlife by keeping it inside. And if they really want to go outside, I have seen some amazing catios on Pinterest that you can build. Another thing you can do to help the Lower Keys marsh rabbit and many of our other threatened and endangered species in the Florida Keys and statewide is to practice sustainable tourism when you're visiting the Florida Keys and really anywhere in Florida. Some ways that you can do this are you can look for the Florida Green Lodging Certification. This is a Florida Department of Environmental Protection program that looks at the different ways that organizations and businesses are helping to support our local ecosystems through energy and water conservation, as well as being good stewards and sharing the outreach message about all of these species. Which brings us to my favorite of the calls to action, which is simply to learn more about the threatened and rare species that we have here. Today, you have already taken a step on that call to action and learned all about the Lower Keys marsh rabbit. But we have endangered species all over the state, throughout the Keys, and probably in a park near you. So do your best to learn about these species and what value they bring to the ecosystem and share that with a friend or family.
Yeah, and I'll just add one more thing, if that's okay. And we've said this a lot, and that's really just your civic engagement piece and getting involved with your elected officials, speaking up, low impact development. I know, and like for us over here, living shorelines is kind of a up and coming movement, again, at least by me. And so speaking up and advocating for that and just, you know, expressing what you want, voting for the people that are going to support those things can really make an impact. So definitely use your voice. And I would be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to our colleague and Florida Sea Grant agent, Holly Beals in Brevard County, for assisting us with some of the research behind this episode and really helping to make this episode possible. Yes. So thank you, Holly. And with that, we will see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Naturally Florida, a podcast about Florida's natural areas and the wild things that live here. Stay updated on new episodes by subscribing on your favorite podcast platform. If you enjoyed today's episode, consider sharing it with a friend. Naturally Florida is produced by your hosts, Shannon Carnavalli
and Lara Milligan.
If you have questions or suggestions, submit them online at naturallyfloridapodcast.com. This podcast is brought to you by the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences Extension, an equal opportunity institution. Thank you for listening.